Joseph Newgarden only had one thing left to say after finally winning a race in the 2025 IndyCar season. Oink, oink. It's for a good reason, I promise. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. No, he doesn't love cops. At least not that I'm aware of, anyway. Welcome to episode 612 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. And a certain Joseph Newgarden fan on this pod is looking at me like he's about to kill me. It's a risk I'm prepared to take. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the final IndyCar race review podcast of 2025. An IndyCar season that finished in August. That really does feel a bit weird. I know they're desperate to get football back on our TV screens again and have his beloved Buffalo Bills destroy my New England Patriots twice a year again, but we made it. We're over. 17 rounds down, 17 races in the books. And finally, after it was all said and done in Nashville, Joseph Newgarden has a home win to close out the year. Into the crowds goes RJ O'Connell. Hello, RJ.
Where is it, Dre?
Where's what?
Where's the takes? Where's the lava? Where's all the mainstream media hit pieces? Complaining about the lack of the interviews. Complaining about the lack of accountability for all the scandals that should have fallen all the team. Where's all the hot lava? I want to hear. Don't tell me that this paddock is full of, I've heard of fair weather fans, but fair weather haters? Oh, that's something different. That's something different entirely. Or, Trey, maybe you're right. Maybe it's not all as black and white as it's all been laid out over the past 2 years. And maybe, just like WWE fumbling the bag with one of their handsome, square-jawed, superstar franchise players' heel turns, maybe this heel turn was just forget about it. Throw it in the garbage. We're back, baby!
Yeah, I just didn't want you guys to forget about me, that's all, said Joseph after winning an oval race to close out the season. Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I am partly a shit stirrer in this mess, but there was at least some logic to my madness as to the ides of Joseph Newgarden and how he was being perceived in the series. Hey, I was the one who always said this was a complicated matter with no straightforward answer, and that's probably why we had so many hot takes and fair weather hating in the first place. But here we are. It's come full circle for the first time.
Salvaged one.
You got one. You got one to close out the year, which means the dishonor of a Penske winless season goes only to Scott McLaughlin. Bad luck, son. At least you're still employed by the team. Oh, wait, they actually did it. Will Power's gone.
I'm checking in the back here. We got more potential bombshells that we need to talk about here, along with reviewing the Nashville race. We'll review the Nashville race first, but Dre, first and foremost, why don't you tell the good folks at home where you can find this wonderful podcast?
You can find it in many different places on this here interwebs. You can find it on youtube.com/motorsport101, including full video podcasts and highlights as well in the shorts tab. Keep an eye on those. You can check us out on facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on Twitter at motorsport_101. We're on Instagram at motorsport101pod and on TikTok at m101_podcast. Again, all the video highlights are on YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok. You can check us all out on there. If you prefer your content more of the written variety, you can also head over to the website, motorsport101.com. Check out the blog section where I did the courtesy of reviewing both this race in Nashville and Formula One's Dutch Grand Prix from Zandvoort this past weekend. Do stay tuned as well. The usual Dre Harrison tradition of the three-part IndyCar season review will be starting soon. Currently going through Prima as we speak, and that's a complicated meatball in its own right. But part one should be out probably early next week is what I would say, tentatively. It's the biggest one I'm ever going to write because we have 11 teams now to discuss rather than 10. So it's a bit more process, but, you know, we're getting there. It's it's a lot to break down, but keep your eyes peeled on that. Keep an eye on me on social media. I'm on Blue Sky, Dre Harrison, Libby Scott at social, Twitter, at Harrison101HD. Sorry, no, Dre Harrison, that's my old username. Dre Harrison101, and of course, RJ O'Connell is over on Blue Sky, RJ O'Connell at BSky.social. If you really, really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon. Patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our content, and that's podcasts, highlights, and occasional some written stuff too. I will probably dump a full team season preview, or review, I should say, on the Patreon before it goes out. So maybe Prima. That's an interesting one. You can have that as soon as it's ready. So you can back us on Patreon at any level. You can get that over the course of the next couple of weeks. You can back us at the $10 level if you want, and you can get access to listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded in our Riverside audience, such as Ghost Raptor and Jason, who are doing so right now. Thank you very much for your continued support, gentlemen. Without further ado, let's get into a whole load of IndyCar stuff, but predominantly the Music City Grand Prix from Nashville.
That is right. We're back at Nashville Super Speedway. A little bit outside the core of Nashville. But we had a very interesting race. I would say, if not the race of the year, then it's certainly top three. And I don't know if it's three. It may not be two. It's certainly top three, but yes, Pat O'Ward had a tire blowout that took him out of the lead. Alex Palou was battling Pato early on. He had a tire blowout, still came back and had a chance to win it, but thanks to some excellent pit work to move up the field, and then an error from his teammate Scott McLaughlin as they were battling for the lead, and McLaughlin narrowly avoided damage of his own after grazing the wall. Newgarden caught, passed, and held off Alex Palou down the stretch to take that first win of the 2025 season at his home circuit. Remember, Joseph Newgarden is from Hendersonville, Tennessee. That's Nashville Metro. Remember, he got his very first win at what was effectively his old home race at Barber Motorsport Park 10 years ago. He's now won a race in at least the last 11 seasons, and it's Penske's second win of the year. A year that everybody from Jonathan Duguid to Tim Cindric and Roger Penske and everybody will likely want to forget. So, Dre, I've said part of my piece about Joseph Newgarden's performance. I've said the facetious, you know, braggadocious me playing Joseph Newgarden Hawk RJ. I got some more thoughts, but I want to hear about this race from you, Dre, because this was generally, I think this was the most fun race of the year.
It was the highest rating I've given the IndyCar race in 2025. I'm inclined to agree. This probably was IndyCar saving its best weekend till last. I was debating between 8 and 8.5 on this one. As a small blog spoiler for you. But yeah, this probably was the most fun IndyCar race of the season. The early skirmish between O'Ward and Palou, and the fact they were pretty much side by side for 5 laps straight, was wonderful racing. Yeah. You know, side by side at 200 miles an hour is just ridiculous stuff to watch.
That's why people want more super speedways on the calendar.
And it's weird because I'm not sure Nashville as a super speedway is a super speedway, but I mean, the average speed's about 200 mph. I would call that a super speedway, but
it is, but it's not like, it's not Michigan fast. It's not Texas fast. No. It's not Auto Club fast. May it rest in peace.
No,
it started to lull. There was a bit of single file, but me personally, I would prefer it if this wasn't a 225 lap pack race from start to finish. I don't know. Maybe that's just me.
No, I think that's more than fair to say. I don't miss the days when Texas was a pack race either. And there's unfortunately more morbid examples in not so recent history of IndyCar. But no, this is the sort of race as to why people have pushed for more ovals of the, I guess you could say, hybrid variety, if you're not sure about where Nashville fits on that scale.
Yeah.
But it was a fantastic start. The crescendo of Palou and Pato being side-by-side was wonderful racing. The finale at the end with Palou looking to try and find a way around Newgarden and then McLaughlin and Kiffin Simpson pretty much side-by-side all the way to the end in the fight for third was again, wonderful racing. The best Kiffin Simpson has probably ever looked on an oval, quite frankly. Was a little bit fortunate about how strategy broke out, but if you can run side by side with Scott McLaughlin, who is one of the best oval drivers in the world, yeah, and a guy that has won on ovals and has contended anywhere in IndyCar at this point, that's a genuine sign of the young man's progression in the series, and that was great to see. Nashville, as much as this isn't the intended destination for Nashville on the IndyCar calendar, we've had 2 years here now, and they've both been pretty fun races. They've been strategic. Yeah. I don't think the tires and the compound played a huge role in this race, really, yeah, by the time it was all said and done. But, well, not the compounds of the tires anyway. More on that in a minute. Yeah. But the actual strategy and the race itself, the way it shook out, wasn't really a factor, but it was still, in my opinion, a very entertaining race that you didn't know who was going to win until right at the very end. And personally, Newgarden, in my opinion, was owed this one. I don't think his oval form has been anywhere near as bad as the scoreboard makes out. I said at the time in Iowa, he was the class of the field that weekend. He should have really won at least one of those two races. He was unlucky in race one on the overcut from Pato. Race two, he was the fastest man there, in my opinion, and the cautions just went completely against him on strategy.
Yeah,
Newgarden is still a very, very lively threat on any given oval we go to in IndyCar, and he was bound to win one of these again eventually, and this was the one where I don't think he was maybe the outright fastest driver, but he didn't make a mistake. He held his nerve. The strategy played out, and Newgarden himself brought it home when it mattered most, and that's how you win races in IndyCar sometimes.
For sure. There was a pit stop cycle under yellow where Joseph comes out in the lead, and I thought that's the moment where he likely wins this race or still has a shot, because he didn't have the fastest car in qualifying for the first half of the race when Pato O'Ward was the class of the field. It looked like Newgarden had maybe a top five car, maybe a podium car if everything broke right, but not like game-breaking pace. But he got himself out to the front. The pigs, his pit crew. You know, Scott McLaughlin's got the Thirsty Threes. His crew has a name. Lately, they've called themselves the Pigs. That's what they're called now. And I'll say this about Penske. For as bad a season as they have had, most of the year, the pit crew has never let them down.
The pit crews have not been the problem at all in 2025. The hardworking men and women of that team behind the pit wall, they are the class of the field. They were in the mix again for best pit crew. That went to Scott Dixon today, we found out, funnily enough, in the number nine team. But the Penske pit crew have got glistening reputations for a reason. It was arguably one in pit lane. McLaughlin was a factor because of his pit lane work as well in this race. And on another day, he could have potentially won this race. At one point, it was Newgarden and McLaughlin side by side as teammates fighting for the victory, like it was the last time he raced at Texas. And until McLaughlin made a mistake and drifted a bit too high and brought out a caution and was lucky he only grazed the rule for superficial damage. So it's Penske. They found a way where at one point all three of their cars are in contention for the win. This is the Penske that we used to seeing from them. They are arguably the best short oval team in IndyCar and have been for the last half decade or so. Willpower, unfortunately, kind of screwed his own race over in the end by just some unfortunate driving into the pit crew, missed his box. But McLaughlin and Newgarden were contenders the whole way through this one. And that's the Penske we've come to expect. It's just a shame it's come far too late this season to have any real effect on the standings besides pride, really. More than anything, they avoided the winless season back in Portland with Power. They've got an oval win to close out the year. We expected that from them. It's still a very disappointing season by their lofty standards.
Oh, for sure.
But it's something. And if I've learned anything from Red Bull, like in 2020, when they won the last race there with Max Verstappen before 21 happened, and the way that season played out, sometimes you just want to go home happy. it means something. Yeah.
And I know Joseph Newgarden will be going home happy. I think he said himself he's going to try this again. He's going to try and take this long off season to reset. And I sincerely hope that getting this win at his home race at a track where before he made it big in racing, he was there as a spectator going to IndyCar and NASCAR races growing up when he was 10, 12 years old. I hope that winning here, and I hope that the time helps get him back to where he should be, back to being somebody who really, really loves doing this and can go back and win everywhere. Because I know we'll have the conversation about, has Joseph Newgarden just because of become a one-tool driver now? I'm sure that will come up in our season review. Stay tuned for details. But I'd like to think that this will give him a reset. I appreciate that he thanked the team behind him because no matter who seems like they've turned their back on Joseph Newgarden, the team never had. The team always had his back, and he had the team's back. They've always given him a car that was good enough to compete in races through many times this year. I'd say he might have had a chance to win his third straight Indy 500, if not for that big cartoon anvil made of karma just dropping right on him in the last quarter of the race. And look, I never believed the whispers that he'd walk away from the sport. I know that's something that was reported and whispered around the paddock, and not just from people who only have 250 Twitter followers who are clearly shitposting that are being taken at face value for some reason. But let's say he did call it a career. Let's say he walked away right now at age 34. Only 9 other people have more wins. Only 10 others have more wins at the Indy 500 specifically. And only 13 others have more national championships in the history of American open wheel racing. Cut through all the lava, cut through all the BS over the last 2 years. He's still one of the best we've ever seen. And I'm glad that he got this one. I would love to see a resurgence in form in 2026. But I'm happy he did not end with a completely humiliating winless season.
More than one thing can be true at once, that Joseph Newgarden, if he hung it up tomorrow, would be one of the all-time greats of the series. He had, in my opinion, a good half-decade run where he was the undisputed number one driver in IndyCar, quite frankly, where he was winning anything and everything that moved. Dixon was the only man in his wheelhouse, really. Most of the time they were fighting. He made Penske his team, which is a hard thing to do when you've had willpower, Simon Pagenaud, and then obviously later on with McLaughlin, who's risen to become an elite driver in the series in his short time with them, relatively speaking.
Yeah, but don't forget Helio Castroneves in his first year in the team.
And Helio did everything but win a national title. Even in his last season with the team, he still won a race that year. He had the best of the best around him in IndyCar, and he still found a way to be the face of Team Penske and arguably the face of the entire series at times. So the other half of the coin is, he has regressed a little bit in the last 2 years. The stats are indisputable. He has lost his way a little bit in the last 2 years. I wouldn't necessarily say that's all his fault. IndyCar is a series of circumstances. There's a lot of things outside of your own hands that can potentially affect your championship, your season, your individual races. Some of that's on Joseph. Some of that is on outside of circumstances. It happens. That's sport. So it's going to be an interesting crossroads for Joseph going into 26. I'd argue this probably was his weakest IndyCar season since probably the start of his career back in 2014.
Yeah. 2012, 2013, 2014, his first real stint at Sarah Fisher-Hartman Racing, where it did not start great, but incremental progress was made. By 2015, he's a race winner, and by 2017, he's convinced Roger Penske to roll the dice on him. We'll talk a little bit more on a similar thread here in a moment, but
sure.
I mean, Dre, we got to roll it back a bit because Alex Palou finished second. He was in the midst again. It should not be a surprise that he was competitive on a oval or super speedway going forward. It's no longer a surprise. And he did this after cutting a tire early on. He did this while having Graham Rahal hold him up for 2 laps. And he did this after probably getting hosed on at least one yellow. He still came back and finished second.
It goes to show you how utterly ridiculous this man has been all year, where, look, let's see, the fact that we didn't even recognize he had a cut tire until he was halfway down pit road, and we were like, hang on a minute, why is the car grabbing? And then realizing, shit, he had a puncture about a thousand yards prior, but he was able to control the car in a calm manner, get it down pit road, get it changed, suffer no actual lasting damage, and only lose 2 seconds to the lead by the time it was all said and done.
Yeah, he was very fortunate that it was happening just before the start of a round of green flag pit stops. He only lost a net 2 positions.
The timing was fortunate. It was the early part of the window, and that ended up becoming Palou's whole strategy, because he was 5 seconds back with 50 laps to go. He comes in early on a big undercut and then undercuts the whole field to come back out in front. I mean, ultimately, Palou, and he'll be the first person to admit this, he openly admits that he was better in the 2 oval races he actually... Okay, let me rephrase this. He was better in the 1 oval he didn't win in Milwaukee than the 2 he actually did win this year at the 500. And, you know, at Iowa earlier this season. But the car wasn't there this time for him. He struggled a lot more in traffic compared to Milwaukee, is basically what I'm trying to say here. And I don't think he ever had a car that could have won. But the fact, despite all of that BS, he still found a way to finish in second is a testament to just how ridiculously good Alex Palou has been all season long. And I was thinking about this with some of the other guys in our Discord server earlier this week. How many races out of the 17 we've had this season has Palou had no chance of winning?
I would say, look, even before the dust-up with Malukas at Detroit, I didn't think that was going to be the one where his winning streak was most in jeopardy, I'd say.
Probably. I mean, I looked at the Wikipedia page, worked it out. I think 2, maybe 3. He was on Kirkwood's winning strategy in Detroit, so he had a chance there, and he was 5th when Malukas put him in the wall. Doable. Because there were other guys who were off sequence at the end of that race. I would say race 1 in Iowa, he finished in 5th. He had a very good car, but not a great car, and it never really looked like he was going to win that one. You could maybe argue Toronto, but he was on a potentially winning strategy until Alex Rossi's wall hit.
And he led 30. The most laps in that race.
And he led the most laps in that race as well. So I would argue 3 times all year did Palou have no chance of winning a race. And it goes to show you, because how many top 5 finishes did Alex Palou have in IndyCar this season? 14.
I would argue maybe swap out Toronto for Portland, because that was always going to be Will Power's race to win.
Yeah, you could maybe talk me around into the traffic jam. You don't want to be the 3rd car in a queue in IndyCar. We all know how dirty air works in the series now. Stingray Rob being the main character of, I'm a lapped car. I'm going to be on TV now and get some air.
Today playing the role of Stingray Rob in this race is Graham Rahal for some reason. Guy just looked like he was tired.
And you look at the result sheet. Graham Rahal was 5 laps down by the time it was all said and done.
Get that thing off the road, bruh.
I know we rag about RLL and their lack of oval prowess over the years. They've generally been a bit better than that in the last year or so. But Graham was so bad on this
Jason
one.
Jason points it out. He's got the washed-up go-away S-Pac heat.
Yeah, it's the Becky Lynch slapping CM Punk in the face multiple times promo from Raw. I'm just like, yeah. I got your ball sweat on me. And I'm like, just go away, Becky. You're better than this. It's that kind of heat. It's grim. Graham drove that race like a loser. I'm just going to be completely frank with you. Because not only was he so slow, not only was he 5 laps down and blatantly blocking, and for some reason wasn't penalized for it when others did for blatant blocks, the fact that it seems specifically targeted for Polo is not a good look at all.
I think that this was just a cascading series of coincidences that Graham Ray Hall is just was having a really, really awful race. And of all the guys that he couldn't let through, Alex just happened to be the one for two laps.
Yeah, it's I hope it's just coincidental rather than anything more malicious or cynical.
Because, like, Graham Ray Hall has no reason to beef with this dude.
No, none. Like, but that's the. It wouldn't be the first time Graham Ray Hall would have held a petty grudge for reasons that are a bit nonsensical. So, you be the judge at home, quite frankly. But, you know, I did not appreciate the way he drove that race. And it sums up what's been a pretty miserable season for Graham. 19th in points by the time it was all said and done. Just a grim year for him and a grim year for RLL.
And Pato Award, man. Unlucky. Like, we'll talk about, like, this is one of those rare bad days from Firestone where they had two big tire cuts during the race. Polo was lucky to get away with his. Pato did not. He crashed out of the lead because his right front tire went in the middle of a corner, which sucks because Pato had the car to win this race from the very start. The only time he was challenged was that side-by-side skirmish with him and Polo, and Pato eventually won that little arm wrestle.
He did. He didn't want to give up the inside line. That was probably the slightly quicker line at the start of the race. And then everybody got back into fuel saving. Let's hit this number mode like we so often do on the short oval in IndyCar.
Yep.
Pato was probably the quickest dude here. He had a huge pole position in qualifying by 3/4 of a mile an hour over David Malukas. You must be thinking, second time I've been out qualified by 3/4 of a mile an hour in a week. What's the odds of that? And by two different dudes as well. But yeah, like, Pato for me was the fastest guy here this weekend. He probably should have won this race. He was leading pretty comfortably when that cut tire happened. And I can't deny, and I'm surprised that more people aren't besides Pato. You know, Pato loves a good call out, but yeah. Pato, like, I'm surprised more people haven't called out the fact that we've had 5 tire blowouts on short ovals this season from 3 different teams, because Andretti had that horrible time in Iowa. I think it was Iowa race 2 where they had 3 blowouts over the course of that weekend. I don't know how much of that was setup choice for Andretti. I don't know for sure. But when it's happened 3 times to Andretti in one weekend, then twice in another race where it happened to Polo and then Pato, at what point do you go, this is probably more than just a coincidence? Because 5 blowouts in one season is a concern.
Yeah, for what happened to Andretti, I'm willing to put that down as setup choice. For this is the one where it's just like, you know, Firestone has a bad day, you know, and they need to look at what they found out of this race and work on that to make sure that it doesn't happen again when we go back to Nashville and when we go back to Gateway, when we go back to Milwaukee, when we go to Phoenix, because that's going to be, if they're going to Phoenix, that is going to be somewhat new for them. They've never driven this generation of IndyCar around this track in its current configuration. The good news is that they have a lot of, like, benefit of the doubt relative to, I don't know, Goodyear and NASCAR, who seem like they are always around the corner of a tire controversy, of a quality control controversy in their sport. Damn, I've just made this about NASCAR again. My bad. but yeah, when it's happened to 2 different drivers on 2 different teams, that should raise eyebrows. But I'd hope that Firestone looks into this. Just like I hope that they're looking at their road and street course tires and how to redevelop those around, you know, the heavier cars.
It's not been a good year for Firestone, if we're being frank. Like you said, 5 tire blowouts is not ideal. Again, you could probably put Andretti's down to setup, but they got the road and street course green tire wrong this year, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. It was too big of an extreme we had people legitimately dumping green tires after 2 or 3 laps. There's tire strategy and then there's farcical sort of. extreme stunts where we're getting like Pirelli F1 2013 compounds where the softer tire choice is lost in literally about 500 yards before it starts experiencing wear. That's not, for me, in my opinion, racing. I think that's gimmicks. And I know we normally only use gimmicks to describe rule changes that go wrong, but I fully agree with you, RJ, that I think with the heavier cars, they need to look at this again. These cars are about 40 kilos or about 100 pounds heavier than what they were pre-hybrid system, and the green tire on the street tracks we went around just did not work. They were they were not usable. They were wearing out too quickly, and when strategy becomes a game of let's get off this compound as soon as we feasibly can, I just don't think that makes for good racing, personally.
No, neither do I. And I know it'll come up that, like, oh, we had the mandatory 2 alternate stint rule in this race, but as you mentioned, Dre, I don't think that it did all the heavy lifting to make this a good race.
I barely noticed the difference, to be honest. I don't think there was a huge difference between the usability of the red and the black tire. I think they were both equally viable. I know they had to get 2 alternate stints in before the race was over in what was ultimately a 4-stop race because of the timing of the cautions and just that classic need for having fresh rubber at the end. We've seen that happen so many times in IndyCar where you want to be on fresh rubber at the end of the race and take advantage of that extra pace where you could. Yeah, I just think that, you know, I just don't think the whole strategy play of mandatory tire stints ultimately made a huge difference in this one. If it did, it was very marginal. I'm not saying don't do it on ovals, but if you're going to try it, you probably need a bigger variance than the one we had here.
Yeah, for sure. Again, this was easily top 3 race of the year for me. Dre gave it his highest rating of the season. I was very pleased with the way this race turned out. If we didn't have the 2 tire blowouts, if we didn't have, and we may talk about later how blocking giveth and blocking taketh away the Rookie of the Year title. But otherwise, that was very entertaining. And now on to the silly season bombshells.
Round 1, fight. We got this today in the world of IndyCar with the season now over. Willpower is officially a free agent, and we got the word at about 2 p.m. this afternoon UK time that he's been released from Penske after 17 years with the team, 42 of his 45 career wins, 4 full-time on the all-time IndyCar wins list, 64 of his all-time 71 record-breaking pole positions, his 2018 Indy 500 win, his 2 IndyCar Series titles in 2014 and 2022, all came with Penske. Will released as part of the team statement, saying, quote, "It's been the honor of my life to drive for Roger and the Penske organization. We've accomplished so much together, and I will always be grateful for my time with the team and my teammates who have supported me along the way. After much consideration, I felt like a change for me was the right move at this time." It is overwhelmingly expected that David Malukas will take the number 12 seat for 2026 as his replacement.
Yeah. One thing about that statement and from Roger himself, Roger said Will felt that it was time for him to make a change beginning with next season. So they are phrasing it as if Will was not pushed. Will jumped before he could be pushed.
That's the big shocker in all this, and we got it from outside sources as well, that Will basically told people, was prepared to listen, that he was offered a deal. He could have taken a 1-year deal to stay with the team. From what I was told, Will wanted 2 guaranteed years on his contract to take him through to what would be his age 46 season. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Penske apparently was only prepared to offer a 1+1. Will didn't like that, and apparently as a result, he chose to leave.
Yeah.
So that might be the real interesting twist in all this. We were all thinking going in that this was going to be Roger doing what he did to Helio, where he got to a certain age, you think you're past your best, you know, now's the time to put someone new and fresh in there. And that person was Joseph in that instance. Yeah. This was different. This was Will choosing to leave of his own volition.
Yeah, and I want to go back there. Joseph stepped in and replaced another guy that they thought was too old to get the job done, Juan Montoya. Juan Montoya, 1 year after being so close to winning his second IndyCar title in 2015, after 2016, his full-time career is done. Joseph hops into his seat. Elio lasts one more year, gets the win at Iowa. He's amazing, but then Roger's like, we got this new sports car program and we really want to downsize, but we don't want to leave you completely out of work. So drive that and also come back, run with us in the Indy 500. This is the end of an era that started very unexpectedly, because we all know Will Power was probably staring down a future where his IndyCar prospects, his prospects of staying in the sport after 2008, were not looking good. And then, as it just so happens, Elio Castroneves is embroiled in a legal controversy over tax evasion. So Will's got to step in, and he crushes it. He crushes it so good that Penske has to start up a brand new team around Will Power because they can't not have him on the track. He's just that good. Mm. And he's been here for 17 years. I mean, we just went over all of the statistics, and we don't even mention that, like, Will's career progression is like an entire journey of itself, for just being like the best road and street course guy, could never win the big one, to a champion. And then he gets his Indy 500 win. And one thing's for certain, whatever problems were going on at Team Penske, I don't put it on Will. And I know a lot of other people do not put this on Will Power. And I'm very interested to see what he does next. It'll tie into something we're talking about next, potentially, because there is a very intriguing future destination for him. I think it would be wise for him to try and stick around for one more year at a competitive team, to try and see, you know, just to try and prove his point. We've seen it before. Elio won number four with a different team after being let go from Penske.
This is a fascinating case. I mean, in my personal IndyCar journey, Will Power was the reigning champion in the first season I watched in full, 2015. He just won in 2014 and taken the number one plate, and he was seen as the guy when I first got here. He was the final boss of IndyCar, and, you know, the progression of his career from guy that was looking like he was going to be out of the sports at one point to blunt Australian with a dirty mouth and becoming meme famous for the double bird salute before as well. He was a guy that was just as infamous as he was famous for how well he could drive a car, but just overall one of the fastest drivers this series has ever seen. He was quick anywhere and everywhere. He was almost always a threat week to week to win any given race on paper. As you said, the oval stuff took a little while for him to really get down. Then he became the best oval driver in IndyCar around the time he won the 500 in 2018. And then he suddenly was able to become the three-tool driver we now know him for. And then he became more Zen-like around the time he won his second title in 2022. He got the nickname of the Zen Master because he was no longer blowing his lid at every racing incident that he was involved in, and he was trying to be calm and rational, and that didn't last long. But it was nice that he gave it some thought. And the thing with Will is that it has never been boring with him in IndyCar. Mm-hmm. There has always been a story. There's always been more that meets the eye with Will, and that's partly what makes him such a fascinating part of IndyCar's history. Even as recently as last year, when his poor wife Liz was battling a staph infection and nearly died, if you watched 100 Days to Indy, I've always said that's the best episode they've ever produced of that show, where Liz is on the rebound after nearly dying, and you could see the clear mental effect it was having on Will, and how much it affected him. He was threatening to punch Grosjean in the face. He shoved Scott Dixon, that same weekend in 2023 after a practice crash. And there's never a dull moment with this man. I completely agree with you, RJ. The dramas and the scandals of the last 2 years that Penske's been involved in.
That
could be its own separate podcast.
And remember, this is not like a lot of the people that were likely with Will for a lot of this time. Some of them are still here in bigger roles now because of it. But a lot of those people like Tim Cendrick and Kyle Moyer and et cetera, are gone.
Exactly. That the whole senior management that we know from Penske is no longer with the team. There was over 50 years of experience between the guys that were all let go with Cendrick and Moyer, etc. But we got to remember, Will Power was not the one that pushed the button during the push-to-pass scandal. He followed the rule book to a T. His car happened to be illegal, but he gained no advantage from it, you know. And again, this time around, it wasn't him that was smoothing out attenuators on the side of his car. It was his crew and Penske's, maybe you could say, arrogant mantra towards its own perception of its race cars and their beauty more than a performance gain. But that wasn't on Will. Will, if anything, Will has been the quiet, more withdrawn voice of reason the last couple of years compared to Newgarden, who's been, for lack of a better term, swept up under the theatrics a little bit. He is a theatre kid after all. Yeah. And McLaughlin, who's had no problem getting his hands dirty, being combative, and, you know, never seen a fight he's not picked on social media or on track. Will has been the more restrained, the more level-headed one of the three, and I don't think it's a coincidence that this season he's been the best of their three drivers. He's been the one that's got his head down, cracked on with it, and ultimately he's reaped the rewards. And I think the one thing that sums up this situation best was when he did win at Portland earlier this season, and the first thing you heard on the radio was, "Where's my respect, motherfucker?" I think this is a man who was frustrated that it had even gotten to the end of the season and they weren't talking about a contract extension or talking about finding a way of keeping him on longer. Will felt like he clearly had earned the right to basically a golden handcuff steal, and Roger wasn't prepared to give that to him. And I will respect Will immensely for knowing his worth and thinking that, no, I'm not just going to settle for peanuts just because it's Team Penske. I will go out and prove my own way. And I don't, that was not the actions of a man who sounds like he's retiring.
And like he even said to Jenna Fryer, the Associated Press, I know. He said to her that like he wants to keep doing this until he's 50 to prove a point. And that's driven a lot of other athletes just like Will. He's still motivated. We'll see if it turns out to be, you know, a situation like Helio Castroneves, where he finds one last second win of his career before he hangs it up. If he hangs it up now, like if IndyCar gave away golden jackets, if they had a Hall of Fame, he walks straight into a golden jacket within minutes, man. Like
he's a
first bout Hall of Famer, if ever such a thing existed, specifically for American open wheel racing, right? It could end up like Lewis Hamilton and Ferrari. Talk about it on our next episode. But man, it's the end of an era, because for a lot of people, when they started watching IndyCar, the only constants were Will Power in the 12, Scott Dixon in the 9. And we're only going to have one of those constants.
Very much so. He is one of the real veteran presences within IndyCar. And I think of the 12, I think of Will Power, and I think of IndyCar because of Will Power, from the double bird salute to the incredible qualifying laps to the raw speed to the calling Alex Tagliani a wanker. There are so many marquee moments in this series where you don't get to tell the story of IndyCar without Will Power. Yeah. And it really does feel like the end of an era. And look, in any sporting sense, 17 years with one team is an incredible knock. Lewis Hamilton, the greatest F1 driver we've ever seen, did 12 with Mercedes. Add another half decade, and that's Will Power at Team Penske.
Yeah.
Another five seasons on top of that. It's an incredible tenure. It's an incredible run. And one that Will clearly does not think it's over. And again, I would love to see, I can't wait to see what he does next. It's going to be weird seeing Will in anything other than a Penske. But like yeah. I said, this is not the actions of a man who is retiring.
Yeah, it's going to be very weird if what people are suggesting could happen does happen and Will Power drives that car. But let's just keep it to Penske for a second.
Mm.
It looks like it has not been confirmed because Penske said the announcement's coming, that David Malukas, who was on a Penske trajectory program, was with AJ Foyt last year with Penske support, will be the odds-on favorite to take over the number 12 car. Discuss.
Good luck, kid. No pressure taking on the number 12 car. The car, the house that Will Power built, essentially, in metaphorical and literal sense. Look, I've said it many a time before. I like David Malukas. I think he has immense upside, especially on ovals. I just don't think the timing is right on this one yet. I think this feels like it's a year too soon. And okay, Penske's kind of had its hand forced. I think Penske clearly wanted to keep Will, but on their terms. So this was not supposed to happen, right? But now that he's gone and actually walked away, they've got to put Malukas in now. And I think he should be at the front of the queue over Santino Ferrucci. I think Malukas was better than Ferrucci this season in their raw test of teammates. Not by a huge margin, I must say. Ferrucci was close. He had a road course podium as well at Road America. Let's give him some due. They were pretty evenly matched in the standings. The concern I have about Malukas is his road and street course form. I'll let you in on a little advanced number secret for you here from my season review that's coming up soon. I split the rankings into road and street courses and oval points. It's actually quite a startling polarization here. Will Power was sixth this season in road and street course points scored. He was 20th on ovals. Now, I don't think that's the reason why Will's gone. Of course not. There's other reasons for that. But Malukas was sixth best on ovals this year on points scored. Pretty damn good. He was 16th on road and street courses. Now, I would make the argument, given the makeup of the Penske team right now, Newgarden, McLaughlin, one guy's won 2 500s and can win an oval race at will. McLaughlin, arguably, ovals is still his strongest suit, in my opinion, as a race car driver. Do you need a third oval specialist right now? I'd argue I don't think you want another guy who's struggling around road and street courses to inherit this seat right now. I get it. Maybe Penske doesn't have a choice because there's not a huge open market out there. From what I'm hearing, I'd argue Rinus VK might have been a better name for a seat like this right now over Malukas. I think a little bit of extra experience, a little bit more of a balanced driver, I think would have been a slightly more beneficial fit. But maybe just him being in the Penske setup will iron some of that out. They've still got a lot of very experienced heads in that crew. And look, Penske's now got a Gen Z star they can build their team around for the future. We all know Little Dave is a very well-liked, very popular driver on the internet, and he will probably win a short oval or two in that Penske, to say the least. He is very, very good on a short oval, and I'm stunned he hasn't won one of those yet.
Yeah, fascinating. Hear me out on one thing. Now, you are right in that Will Power on form alone should not have been dropped, although it sounds like, from what they're saying, he walked before he could be pushed. If he was pushed, it would not have been for performance reasons.
No.
I think we can all agree. Hear me out, though. Roger Penske, Jonathan Duguid, all those people, they are not the only people that have seen something in David that we haven't yet at this level. There are diecasts that have been sitting on pegs and stores and pop-up shops around America that are proof of this. There is social media material that is proof of this.
Mm.
The problem with that is that Zach Brown didn't want to wait one more month to let his wrist heal up. He was going to be the driver of the number six car in 2024, and who knows how long afterwards. But he breaks his wrist in the off season. And McLaren decides our sponsors will not be pleased to have a driver that's not there long term. So let's get rid of him and let him fend for himself. And then he ends up on this Penske trajectory program, which could be very, very fascinating to look back on in hindsight. I think he will be very good on super speedways. I think he has a very good chance to win in Indianapolis 5. He finished second at this year's 500. He's always a threat to win at Gateway. Two of his three podiums have come at Gateway. I also think, and I'll talk about this more in the season review, the other side of the game is coming. He was not a one-tool driver in Indy Lights. He couldn't have been to push Kyle Kirkwood as hard as he did to win that title in 2021. And I have seen glimpses of it throughout this season. I think with a more polished team, I think with some more maturity, it may come.
I hope so, because like you said, it would be harsh to say it's not there at all. There has been flashes of it. I think he has had many a moment for Thoit where he's ran top five. Unfortunately, he has made mistakes. The obvious one, Pelot in Detroit, that was silly and unnecessary, and Malukas immediately held his hands up and just said, that was my bad. Road America was another one as well, where he was way too ambitious on Christian Lundgaard at the start of that one. The pace, the speed is there. I don't doubt that. He just needs more polish. And hopefully Penske will provide that for him, because like I said, they're still one of the better Roan street course teams in IndyCar. They are still one of the highest reputation teams in the series. A lot of that alone could be exactly the ticket that Malukas needs. So, and you're absolutely right. He ran Kirkwood close in Indy Lights, what it was at the time. You don't fluke something like that over a full season. He clearly does have something there. I just need to see more of that, because I think that's what Penske needs right now. It needs a Roan street course ringer. The problem is their best one is just walked away from the team. And that's a hole that I'm not sure Malukas is going to be able to immediately fill. The McLaren situation, I don't hold against David at all. That was more Zak Brown getting itchy fingers for me. And let's not forget, Malukas was never Zak Brown's first choice. And again, I feel a bit bad for Dave, because again, in an ideal situation, David's not Penske's first choice here either. They wanted to keep Will, but you've got to make the mess. You've got to make the most out of this now. Let's see if Malukas can prove me wrong, because I'm a little bit more on the doubty side of the fence on this one, but he's got enough potential there. I go, okay, maybe this can work out.
Yeah. And to throw you a bone for anybody that says, Joseph won three races during his last 2 years at what is now Ed Carpenter Racing, was seventh in points in 2015 and fourth in points in 2016. He accomplished a lot more before Malukas got in the seat. And there's also the risk that, like, Malukas won't be the same fun-loving driver when he comes and steps into auto racing's equivalent of the New York Yankees. Ryan Blaney is still very cool and hip with the kids, but it's not what he was at the Wood Brothers.
No. Wood.
All right. We got another payload down here in this plane, and this looks potentially incendiary.
What do we got?
So even more incredible than the end of Powers time at Penske is a rumor that when it started seemed like nonsense, but now it's gaining traction, is that we may have seen Colton Herta's last IndyCar race for a little while, because the rumors are true. He's going to race in Formula 2 in 2026 with the aim of getting an F1 super license. Andretti Global's new owner, Dan Towers of TWG Motorsport, made it abundantly clear that when he signed Valtteri Bottas and Sergio Perez, the Cadillac F1 team, we'll talk about that more, Towers says he wants to keep the pipeline open for an American F1 driver in the future. But when asked if it meant putting Herta in F2, Towers said, no, that's not what we're reporting, and no. And Herta has also on multiple occasions denied to the best of his abilities speculation on multiple occasions that over the course of this weekend, left open a little bit of the window ajar, but denied it to the best of his abilities. And if the move happens, it's likely that he would join Prema Racing, which is facing its own uncertainties over its IndyCar future. But again, that's another story for another podcast. So I have a feeling we both know the answer to this, but is Colton making the right decision if this is true?
It's certainly bold, is what I would say. My first question in response to this was this. Do you have an F1 seat guaranteed for 2028? Is that something Dan's promised you? If that's the case, fine. Fair enough. You take the leap over and you get those super license points. However, if it's not that, I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Because this is not... This is all kinds of risky. This
Ooh,
is...
Oh, boy. Yeah.
This is hellaciously risky.
Yeah. It's riskier than just trying to get a waiver to see if he could skirt in without the 40 super license points 3 years ago. You remember that saga. We all remember that saga.
I wrote 5,000 words about it on the website. It's one of my favorite pieces ever wrote, talking of breaking down the system, breaking down where Herta fit in, where Palou fit in, and just... When I wrote that piece at the time, and you'll talk about this as well, and I know you've written notes about this as well yourself, the overall conclusion I came to was the problem isn't necessarily the super license, because the people that are good enough in IndyCar to have one, I didn't have an issue with that. We were talking people like Will Power, Scott McLaughlin, Simon Pagenaud, you know, having that...
But none of those guys are realistically going to make the jump over to F1 in their 30s or 40s in that instance.
No, it's just, it's rare that someone's that good in IndyCar while also being that young where an F1 team might consider hiring them. That was the problem I always had with this, was that the issue was not the IndyCar guys aren't talented enough or that they're not even necessarily getting enough points, because you could make a case for that, sure. The biggest issue I had was that IndyCar drivers were not being taken seriously by F1 team bosses for actual serious opportunities to be hired. And the walking proof of that has been Alex Palou. Alex Palou's had two of the greatest IndyCar seasons we've ever seen in the last 3 years. 2023 was arguably an even juicier opportunity for a team to take advantage, because this was when Palou was desperate for an F1 seat. Desperate enough where he was prepared to go to court with CGR to break himself free to go to McLaren, because he thought he had a better shot of an F1 seat than Oscar Piastri did. Oscar Piastri, who is now odds-on favorite to be Formula One world champion in December. Now,
and Oscar Piastri, who was in that paddock the whole time, it was always looking like a long shot. And if Oscar pulled the trigger and broke that deal with Alpine off to go to McLaren, it was inevitable that Palou was going to get screwed out of the deal.
Yeah, it was always going to be a long shot. And this feels like an opportunity where the window closed a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And the part of the problem I have is this, right? Colton Herta just finished 7th in the standings, right? So he got another 5 super license points. He's now on 35, I believe, is the number he's got now.
35, 36. I think some people even worked it out that, like, if he did enough FP1s or if he did enough mileage in an F1 car, he would qualify for a super license already.
Yeah, you get 1 point for every practice session where you complete at least 100 kilometers of running. That's 1 point. So if he did 5 FP1s next year for any F1 team, he would have a super license now, even without racing in Formula 2. I think the Formula 2 attachment comes of trying to learn some of the European tracks or some of the other tracks that are on the F1 calendar in general, and just gaining experience of racing in Europe and what the F1 calendar in general looks like. Because not every F2 weekend is in Europe. They race in Abu Dhabi, for example, as well, on top of that. That's how I look at it. Personally, it says to me, and this is just my opinion, if you think Colton Herta is good enough for an F1 seat, why didn't you just tell him, we'll give you 5 FP1s next year and we'll just put you in F1 in 2026? And then why did you give Valtteri Bottas and Sergio Perez multi-year contracts? That says to me you don't have full faith in Colton, because if you did, you'd have been all in on this. Yeah. This, for me, feels like a feeler, and a very risky feeler, to drop him into what you've called the Mechachrome Lottery.
Well, and rightly so. I didn't always call it the Mechachrome Lottery. I think people in our community have also called it the Mechachrome Lottery, but yes. Formula 2 has a bit of a reputation, specifically power unit supplier Mechachrome, where the quality control is not always the best. I'm not one of these people that believes that Bruno Michel picks favorites and gives them the best engines because that's the drivers that he wants to see succeed. But what I am saying is that it's not always up to the talent of the drivers and the preparation of the teams that dictates Formula 2's success. Now, I want to roll this back a bit. You know why people wanted Colton Herta to come through F1 to IndyCar? It is an American thing. Now, Alex Palou, yes, has more credentials. He's way more in line with Sebastian Bourdais and Juan Pablo Montoya and Jacques Villeneuve, who made the jump before him to IndyCar and then jumped to Formula One and had, well, in Villeneuve's success, he was a world champion, but he flamed out. Montoya could have been a world champion, but he flamed out. And Sebastian Bourdais, well, he flamed out before he could be successful. Anyway, it is an American thing because it has been nearly 50 years since the last American citizen won the Formula One World Championship or even won a Grand Prix. And in my lifetime sense, which is between 30 to 40 years, there have been four American drivers that have started a Formula One Grand Prix, and none of them have lasted two full seasons. The latest being Logan Sargeant, who went through the European ladder and did not turn out to be that guy. But then you have Colton Herta, who, yes, he hasn't won an IndyCar Series title, but he has multiple victories in the series, some big races, some big performances against a field of drivers that have far more experience in a much more professional environment than you have in Formula 2. And hell, if you really know your stuff, you can just point to a 10-year-old photo of him in British Formula 4. He's standing on the podium with a winner's trophy. And to his left, oh, is that Lando Norris in third place, the second favorite to win this year's Formula 1 championship? Yeah, I think the upside is good enough to take that gamble on. Even if he doesn't have the super license, even if he doesn't have the world championships, you could take the path to F1 that the likes of Villeneuve and Montoya and Bourdais have taken before him, and you could prove that you don't have to be funneled through the narrow corridors of the European ladder to make it into F1. And if he doesn't work out in F1, oh well, he can just resume his quest for a title in IndyCar with plenty of years of his prime in front of him. That's what would happen if he made the jump to F1 straight out of IndyCar. Now it's 2026. He's a bit older now. And now the proposition is dangling overhead that he's got to go to Formula 2 to prove his worth. And it's one thing to get rinsed out of Formula 1 in a couple of years if you go straight from IndyCar there and then go back. Like, that shit happens all the time. That's happened to many drivers, better and worse than Colton Herta. There's levels to this. If he gets rinsed out of F2 after two seasons where the results don't come and he just looks like an old guy that can't hang with a bunch of teenagers, early 20s guys that have been running these circuits for years and years and years, even if they're not necessarily as talented on the whole, that could be catastrophic damage to his career prospects. Like, he could come back, but he won't be the same as the same because he will not have held up against a bunch of drivers that he should have beaten on pure talent alone. You need an example? I'll give you an example. Rotomo Miata is struggling in Formula 2 at the moment. Some of that is mechanical luck. Some of that, it just feels like he's really struggling to learn the circuits and he's really taking his time out. I thought after 1 year of F2, like, he'd still be good to get, like, you know, opportunities to race internationally in like WEC or IMSA or what have you, right? I don't think F1 was going to happen, but like something was going to happen. But, and if, especially if what I'm hearing is true, then he might come back for a third season. What does he come back to when this F2 tenure inevitably runs its course. Miata doesn't get the F1 promotion that he wanted, even when Toyota had no business of ever entertaining any ideas of going into Formula One for anything. And why does Colton Herta need that?
The term of Miata is the walking case study as to why this scares me. The numbers suggest Returman Miata's had 13 points finishes and one podium in 48 Formula 2 races in a year and a half of him being in the series. He's struggling. He's openly stated about not having, quote-unquote, the right engines. I think you're right, RJ. He struggled to learn the European tracks, and he's going to be in no man's land if this keeps up for much longer. He needs to get out of that series right now, Rob, because all it's doing at this point is making him stagnant and hurting his reputation. And this is a guy who is one of only seven men ever to do the Super GT, Super Formula, GT500 double that is the crown jewel of Japanese motorsport. And we all
don't
know...
Forget. Super Formula cars have way more downforce than an IndyCar car.
Yeah.
If Colton Herta struggles to adapt, and I know he's done some TPC testing. I know that. But if he's coming straight from IndyCar to F2 and he struggles, oh boy.
Let's not forget, Zach Brown had the chance to see Colton in that TPC car and didn't make any major moves. Zach Brown has had every opportunity in the world to give Pato O'Ward an F1 opportunity. He has not done that. He had a chance to get Alex Palou in a Formula One car, the IndyCar driver of the decade so far, and didn't do so, because the moment Palou found out there wasn't going to be an F1 seat for him and Piastri was signed in, he couldn't wait to not sign that contract. So, again, for me, I think the abundance is clear. F1 teams are reluctant to pull the trigger. And rightly or wrongly, probably rightly, the European ladder has proven to have worked. If anything, the 2025 rookie class, and we'll be talking about them in our next episode, they've been outstanding. They've probably been walking proof that we've been holding on to some of these drivers for too long. Yeah. That, yes, you can gamble on some of these younger talent, and they can perform and deliver. We're celebrating an Isaac Hadja podium finish in his rookie season.
Yeah.
We didn't think that was going to happen a year ago.
Yeah. I thought he was going to be a one-and-done case because it seemed like he had the deck stacked against him. I'll talk more about that in the F1 episode. But, yeah, like... Yeah, it's possible you can come back to IndyCar and succeed. Bourdais elevated teams that were not as good as the ones that he drove in his first IndyCar stint and proved that he was not just a Newman Haas merchant or a depleted Champ Car merchant. Juan Montoya won another championship after leaving for F1, having a NASCAR stint between, and then coming back over a decade and a half later. Colton Herta could pull it off if he got rinsed out of F1, even if he got rinsed out of F2, but... If he gets rinsed out of F2, I don't think people would see him the same way. And that's what scares me, because I think Colton Herta is a future IndyCar champion. I think he is a future Indianapolis 500 winner, whether or not he takes this time off. And I know Colton Herta has said, you know, it intrigues him. It excites him to potentially have that idea to prove all the critics wrong. I just don't know if this is the way to do it. I wish him all the best if this is what happens. And oh, by the way, his seat is where Willpower would end up is if all this happens, according to the rumors and the dirt sheets, et cetera, et cetera. But man, it's going to be so tough and it could go so, so wrong.
This is the overall point that I was going to make. I've used this phrase before on this show. There is so many ways this could go wrong and not very many ways this goes right. It's a bit like playing Jenga and you've already gone through about four or five extra rows and now you're looking at the bricks where you know there's a good chance the tower's about to fall over. I completely agree. this could be a reputation killer, or at least certainly a black mark against Colton Herta's name if this doesn't work out. Because a lot of people who don't have the same kind of good faith that we do about Colton Herta would look at him in F2, see if he finishes like Miata does, for example, and go, well, that guy was never that good. IndyCar's just a terrible series. And no, we do not think this on this show. Yeah. I completely agree with RJ. Colton Herta is arguably should have won last year's IndyCar championship. There were opportunities he left on the table where if he fully executed, he could have beaten Polo last year. Didn't happen. This year was a bit disappointing. More down to his pit crew than necessarily Herta himself. The talent has never been the issue with Colton Herta. Ever. The issue has been arguably the team he's been in. And that team is now pushing him towards Formula 2, a Prima team that has not been the juggernaut that it's been with the previous card that we used to nickname Title Town, because a Prima title was almost guaranteed in F2 year on year. And I'll be real with you. There are F2 prospects that I think are a better shout for F1 in their class right now. Alex Dunn is probably going to be heading to America next year. Leonardo Fornaroli is having a fantastic season as a rookie. He might do the F3, F2 double this year and not get a seat.
Because Arvid Lindblad is there and he's got the clout and he's younger and he's in the Red Bull system and it seems like a seat would open up for him anyway. Oh, man. And we don't even have time to get into all the minutia of what if Rinus VK priced himself out of Dale Coyne after just 1 year? What about the Rookie of the Year battle that swung twice on dumb blocking incidents at Nashville?
Both main contenders of Louis Foster and Robert Schwartzman both get dinged for blocking during the same race, and it was just enough for Foster to win Rookie of the Year by 2 points over Schwartzman. Good for him. You hot messes, the pair of you. Jesus Christ.
Man.
We'll have to keep an eye on this one, and obviously we'll talk about it a little bit more if this does actually get greenlit and confirmed. My overall gut feeling is not this way. I just stick around in IndyCar for another year and basically, and as we say,
the bombshell that Rinus VK has indeed left Dale Coyne after just one season.
Jesus Christ.
All right. So just very quickly before we get out the door, obviously it was a good year for Rinus VK.
Yeah.
Bounced it, got his stocks back up. Very curious to see where he ends up.
He was 14th in points this year in a Dale Coyne. That takes some doing. Mm-hmm. I know Dale Coyne had the help of Michael Cannon in the back half of the year, but that was not the full season for Rinus VK. He's done more than enough to vindicate the guy really is that good. I just think he needs a better team. Foyt would be a great landing spot for him. If Malukas really is going to Penske, which we all think he is, Foyt and having Rinus VK in the 14 car, or the 4 car in this case, would make a lot of sense. I think that would be a very nice team that is now, they're now no longer bored of it. They're a genuine midfield team with upside now. Yep. And Rinus has always been able to punch above his weight in whatever machine he's been in at times. That could be a great fit for him.
More importantly, Rinus VK Indy 500 contender is back on the menu.
Mmm. Tasty. Delicious meals. Delicious meals. Let's get out of here on this one. We'll be back for our IndyCar mainline season review in a couple of weeks' time. Stay tuned on social media for more details on that. In the meantime, you can get some of my long-term thoughts on the website. There'll be a 3-part written season review out in the coming weeks. Keep your eyes peeled on that. Next up, we'll be talking about Formula One and the Dutch Grand Prix at Zandvoort, which is thankfully far less controversial than this weekend has been. But until then, I've been Dre Harrison. He's been RJ O'Connell. Thank you very much for listening and watching along. And until next time, sayonara.
Later, y'all.
Now, could you please hold off on the rest of the news for another week? Please and thank you.
What do you mean the announcement is just that he's moving Space Command to Alabama? I thought this was going to be juicier. Come on.